So now we will pass you over to Mayor Grant Smith, who's going to say a few words.
Kia ora, everybody. Look, apologies for my lateness. I was just answering emails from Joe. But no, seriously, here for this memorial lecture, and I think the these military lectures that Joe and his team run, I think, are really, really valuable. And just want to acknowledge, obviously, the subject is, it was going to be presented by Roy, and I think it's really, and acknowledge family members here today too. Not only did Roy serve his country and look after veterans in later life, for advocating for them, but I know with his passion of painting and all the great work that he gave, and people enjoyed that as well. So look forward to the lecture today, and obviously remembering Roy just the great work that he did as a New Zealander. So kia ora, thank you everybody.
Thanks Grant, I appreciate that. We've had this topic on our program now for well over 18 months, and it was intended that in fact Roy was going to present the session today, but of course unfortunately he passed away a couple of months ago, and you'll hear a little bit more about that because we've got members of the family here who are going to describe some of the work that he did do, which is important, and it still left a bit of a gap for more to follow, a work in progress, you might say. One of our other speakers who was going to talk today, Terry Tahi, who was ex of Royal New Zealand Navy, who served on the Rotuiti during Operation Grapple, was going to give some first-hand experiences, but we don't know what's happened to Terry. He may turn up or he may not. So I think what we'll do is we'll box on, and I'll hand you over to Dr. Al Rowland, who's ex of Massey University, who did the research into the genetic sufferings of those veterans of that particular operation. And I'm sure that between Al and members of the family, we'll be able to get a better idea. So without further ado, welcome Al.
I think Tracy's going to speak first.
Tracy, by all means. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Tracy Sefton-Wiggins, and I'm the eldest daughter of Roy Sefton. I'm sure you'll learn a bit more about Roy, the passionate and dedicated activist today. The man who spent the majority of my adult life fighting the government for the rights, recognition and acknowledgement of the New Zealand nuclear test vets for what I feel was great wrongdoing. He was at 5 of the 7 nuclear detonations at Christmas Island, giving him the absolute right to form the NZNTVA and fight for those who deserve so much more than they have been given for their service. He was not only an activist, though if you Google him, there is many an article online about his fight for the rights to recognition. He was a world-renowned artist. Once again, Google him as an artist, and the page will fill with articles and photos of his art. He was a musician, and he often said towards the end of his life that he was sad he would never drum again. To my sister and myself, he was our dad. This, I feel, was his most important role in life. As I said, I am the eldest of 2 daughters, and we're 7.5 years apart, which is quite an age gap when you're young. My first memory of Dad is him standing on the dock in his Navy uniform when I was about 3. He had slung on his shoulder a blue and pink bike. He was a total stranger to me, as he had been at sea for the majority of my 3 years. My next memory of him was him rescuing me from a wetter down my pyjama pants at my great-grandmother's house in College Street. Thank goodness for Dad. Dad instilled in both of us a great love of animals, just like him. He had a dog named Tuppy that my mother and he would put to bed in her own bed with a pillow and a blanket, and in winter, an electric blanket. She went on many of adventures with Dad around the countryside, and unfortunately he has now left behind his beloved cat Sam, who was amazing company and brought him great joy over the years. For those of you who knew Dad, he was a storyteller, delivering many stories with a deadpan face, and you only caught on at the end when he had a cheeky smile or a hearty laugh. This carried over to his parenting, as did his cartooning. And as a young child, he would draw me bedtime cartoons about a spider, a beetle, and a fly that lived in tin cans and matchbox houses at the local dump with matchstick fences. The stories depicted their daily challenges, but were always delivered with his raw sense of humour and his positive take on life. These were drawn on pink telegraph paper he had acquired from the post office where he was working. His storytelling was where I learnt to never eat the peas that Dad served up. Naval Days 101, drop the peas, sweep them up, serve them. Then there were the adventures he took me on, and recently I took him on. These included weekly trips to the smelly dump with its masses of seagulls. This is where he would forage around for bits, bringing home bits and pieces he thought would be useful. One man's trash is another man's treasure. Weekend trips to car lots, where every car he looked in, he had to pick me up so I could look in also. Trips to Foxton Beach, where he grew up, of which he would regale me with tales about him and the Hooper kids, raising a little innocent trouble. And this is where he taught me to dig for pippies and where my love of shellfish came from. Treasured childhood memories. Of course, in the last few years, I took him on adventures. It's what he liked to call these mundane outings to the doctors, the hospital, the grocery store, or even out for a cup of tea and a pie. These were always enjoyed, with much laughter and storytelling, though he always kept his more risque stories for his friends. Sadly, Dad lost his fight for life on January the 5th, 2021, at 7:12 a.m. Dad left behind his wife, who has sadly passed on March the 2nd, 2021. Two daughters, five grandchildren, and seven great-grandchildren. He took his last breath with his usual poise, with me by his side, and as usual with consideration as he obviously waited patiently for my eldest daughter to burst through the door announcing her arrival. Only then did he take his last breath. His breath slipped quietly from his body, and this complex, resilient, and tireless fighter, our Dad, slipped away. Dad brought up two opinionated and passionate daughters, much to his frustration at times, who strongly believe in the New Zealand Nuclear Test Veterans Association's right to acknowledgement from the government. And we will both keep the fight going, along with both Al Roland and Terry Tahi, and with all the NZNTVAs and their families. Dad told me before he died, he thought that when I argued with passion and patience, which is a rarity at times, I was good as he was at putting my convictions forward. So this is for you, Dad. We will continue the fight for acknowledgement, and we will not be defeated. Thank you.
Kia ora, my name is Al Roland, and I'm the person who conducted the research into the genetics of the New Zealand nuclear test veterans. I was at Massey University, and I first met Roy in the year 2000 when I was approached by him to see whether or not I would conduct a genetic study looking for any genetic damage amongst the New Zealand nuclear test veterans. In the year 2000, the Helen Clark government gave the New Zealand nuclear test veterans a considerable sum of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, to use for whatever purpose they want. And so they were going to use, oh, in fact, here is Terry. And in fact, it might be appropriate for me to introduce Terry to say a few words before I get into the science. So, Mr. Terry Tahi, who is a veteran of several of the bomb tests. He's coming up now, so I'd like to introduce Terry Tahi. Mr. Terry Tahi, please come up the front, Terry. Are you all right? Well, I've just introduced you. If you would like to come to the to the podium, and here is the speaker. Would you like to come to the microphone?
Hold it there. Thank you very much, Mr. Rowland.
That's all right. They want to hear more about what you have to say than me.
Kia ora tātou. Matua ta mawairua tapu mea koe tu ana he ra pono te māngai, hei tau toko mai, ai nei, ake nei, ai. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and faithful angels, be with us forevermore. Thank you. Amine. At 17 and a half, I joined the New Zealand Navy. 18 years, 9 months, I witnessed my first hydrogen bomb test at Christmas Islands. In my mind, when I saw the bomb test, I thought, what a wonderful opportunity to see something like that. It was simply marvellous to see, but not recognizing what effects that bomb would have on all of us. I am still suffering the effects, but I'm 83 now, so I've had a good innings. We were losing guys when they were 40 years old, when they came back from the hydrogen bomb test. And we lost many, many of our sailors. It was disappointing to see something like that happen. But that's the reality. I joined the Navy as a volunteer. Likewise, with everyone else. But then, we did not join the Navy to be guinea pigs, to be sent to these tests that were performed by the British to test the equipment and what effects it would have on the men. That's ridiculous. Having to test bombs to see what would happen to the men. Like I said, when we came back from our bomb test, we were losing guys who were only 40 years old, and I've doubled that age. Why the heck am I still here? We went up there with 650 sailors. We'd be lucky now if we have 50. The British were up there with 23,000 soldiers. The last I heard, they had 3,000 left. All the pilots that dropped the bombs died when they went back home. So it was an experience, I say, of immense gratitude, because when I saw the bomb,
I thought, what a marvellous thing to see. But then again, like I said, we are not guinea pigs. And that's what we were sent up there for. The British sent out a secret message saying that they wanted to test the equipment and test the effects on sailors. They got their answer. We've lost a lot of men. They've lost a lot of men. They were more exposed than we were because they were on the island. They stripped off on the island. One of our boats went through ground zero. That was HMNZS Puka. I was on the HMNZS Rotuiti. We were 60 miles away from the bomb blast. When it went off, the light that it gave, we were fully dressed in our uniform and our dress coat, which was anti-flash gear, dark glasses, our backs towards the bomb test. We covered our eyes with our hands, and you could see the skeleton through the fingers of your eyes, of your hands. It is unbelievable, but that's what happened, that's what we saw. Scientifically, it is not proven, but that is exactly what we saw. So, I think I've had my turn. Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much.
Before you sit down, is there anyone, a couple of questions before I speak?
Oh, yes, sorry.
Are there any questions that anyone would like to ask Jerry?
Back there. Do you think that the government should have sent the ship to Nauru, or was it a foolhardy adventure to send the sailors there after what had happened with Grapple? The difference was, it was underground more so than what the Operation Grapple was. Yeah, it was in the air.
One more question, I think, Mr. Chairman.
I'm Kira Martin, Kota Katoa, Eta Nei.
Kira.
He mihi nui tēne ki a Kota Katoa, ko te matarama, ko takuta.
Kira.
I want to ask the question, how did our government buy into sending its sailors to what was obviously a very dangerous set of circumstances?
British contingents started at Maralinga in Australia. They were kicked out by the Australians. So they looked for another venue and went up to Christmas Islands, which is above Fiji. And that's where we keep on saying, why didn't they go home and drop the bombs? Why come over here? And we've been affected. Everybody around the area been affected by this bomb test.
So our government was effectively coerced into participating?
They were, yes.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Graham. Thank right there, Jerry, would you like to take a seat? Is that all right?
I'm conscious of the time, so I'll keep my address as short as I can. I'd just like to say the When Roy Sefton had inherited, not inherited, but he had received the money from the government, he wanted to have a genetic study conducted of the veterans to see if they had incurred any long-term genetic damage. So he went to St Andrews University in Scotland, which is the top lab in the world looking at radiation damage in humans. And they were very keen to conduct a study, but they couldn't get ethics approval from the British government to go ahead with the study. Of course, they didn't want to know the outcome or if there was one. So they, Peter Bryant, who was the professor at St Andrews, said to Roy, there's one person who might be able to help you in New Zealand. So he approached me, and I talked with my colleagues about doing such a study. We thought 50 years had gone by, the chances of finding anything would be pretty remote, but to do nothing wouldn't be acceptable. So I said to Roy, the chances of finding something is very, very remote, but we would give it a go, and he was happy with that. So we conducted a study, and actually, what I'd like to do is to show you a short clip first of the first hydrogen bomb that the British conducted at Christmas Island. I should make clear to you that there are two types of atomic bombs. There's a fission bomb and a fusion bomb. And the fission bomb, you need an explosion to split the atom and release the energy. And the first three bomb tests that the British did at Maldon Island, near Christmas Island, were fission bombs, and their grapple X explosion was their first fusion bomb, which is otherwise known as a thermonuclear explosion. That requires another explosion to give an atomic explosion to fuse the hydrogen in the bomb and fuse all of the hydrogen atoms, and that releases even greater energy. I would now like, if Maria, could you just show that clip for us, please? It's only about 6 minutes long, but it is the Operation Grapple first hydrogen bomb. They call it the hydrogen bomb.
Well, maybe we might have to skip that, Maria.
Okay, we'll go back. Let's see if we can get the PowerPoint back.
This is an atomic bomb explosion, but it's not one of the Operation Grapple ones, one of the Americans. Obviously, no one would have been in those boats, but they wanted to see what effect it would have. Well, that's just me. Now, the British conducted some tests, as Terry mentioned, in Australia, but they had some blowback unexpectedly over South Australia and even to Queensland, and quite a lot of fallout fell on Queensland, and even Menzies at that stage said, well, I think we better call it a halt here, this is getting too hot, literally. So the Australians approached the New Zealanders, and they were told that they would like some observers to observe the weather, and that's all they were told. Although, as Terry said, lawyers have subsequently found letters in Whitehall which showed instructions in black and white from the British Cabinet giving instructions to the military to conduct some tests to see how closely they could place their own men to a bomb blast to see what effect it might have. And so that's what they did. And so Christmas Island is now part of the Kiribati group. There were two New Zealand frigates, the Pukaki and Rotuiti. The first three bombs were conducted, tests were conducted at Maldon Island, but apparently it wasn't convenient as well for berthing and wharves and things, so they shifted to Christmas Island. And Grapple X, which we are going to show you, was the first hydrogen bomb, and all the ones at Christmas Island were all hydrogen bombs. And the one, the Grapple X, was more powerful than they expected, which the British were pleased about. They knew then that they had got it right for as far as they were concerned. So then you can see that the Pukaki was placed progressively closer to subsequent blasts, all atmospheric, until they were only 20 nautical miles from the bomb, and they were told to turn around and sail through the cloud at the end, and of course all the fallout came down onto them, and they scrubbed the boats, and there is a fellow on the right hand photo. He would place a pallet hidden so that the other chap with the counter could suss it out. It was just as an exercise. And Roy told me that this fellow with the pallet, he went to the doctor on the ship, and he had a terrible rash on his thigh. And the doctor said, "That looks suspicious." And it transpired that he was placing the pallet in his pocket and keeping it there all day, and because it was a radiation burn. And Roy has lots of stories of this. There was one of Ratu Sukamasasi Mara, who was the well-known leader of Fiji in those days, and he was invited to witness a bomb blast, and he got put all the gear on, and then they said, "We'll go and have a walk around Christmas Island after the bomb blast." And they didn't have gumboots big enough for him to wear, so he went around in bare feet. And he had three sons, and they were all sterile, and they all died young, and he himself was very ill for a long, long time. So I could relate lots of stories. One of the ones that I think is hideous is the recording of birds screaming, and they were blind and they couldn't see where they were going. I find that just, we won't dwell on that. So I conducted this study, and we selected 50 veterans and 50 MAT controls. And I had help by a colleague at Massey University, Professor John Pott, who was a human neuroscientist, and he had a lot of experience at selecting participants for study. As a geneticist, I would have just gone, taken the blood and looked, and he said, "No, Al, you have to do a control study," which was very sensible and the right thing to do. So what you do is you have to draw up a questionnaire and interview all prospective participants, and you have to make sure that they haven't been exposed to anything like a solvents or chemotherapy or anything that may have a bearing on the outcome other than the fact that they witnessed the bomb test. So then we had to match the controls, which means we go out, and the RSA were very, very helpful to us finding military people who, again, were matched in every respect in terms of not smoking or smoking and alcohol consumption. And it took over a year to sort that all out. And eventually John got matched controls. And he said to me, "The success or otherwise of the test will hinge on whether or not we've been thorough in selecting our matched controls. Otherwise, the study could be criticised heavily." And in fact, we did. We've never been criticised on the thoroughness that we selected the matched controls. So we travelled all around the North Island collecting controls and detailed questionnaire. And the study was conducted blind. What that means was that when the blood came to us, because we had to take a blood sample to culture the lymphocytes to look at the chromosomes and the DNA, but we, the researchers, did not know who was a veteran and who was an unexposed control subject. So that when we had a look at all the results at the end, and we could compare. Then we were on safe ground if we found anything different. There were five tests that we conducted, but I'd like to concentrate on one called MFISH. You don't have to remember, it's got a long handle, multicolor, fluorescent in situ hybridization. And this is a very powerful test. You've already seen the image? Yeah. Oh, good. This is a dividing lymphocyte showing all the chromosomes, and it's too involved to go into explaining it, but this is a very powerful test for detecting radiation damage. It's one used internationally. We were the first lab to introduce this test into New Zealand. And what you do is you stain all of the different chromosomes a different colour. And there are 23 pairs, because you get one from mum, one from dad, and the two sex chromosomes. So here, if you look at the top, you can see two yellow chromosomes. And they're the two largest chromosomes, the chromosome ones, and halfway along there's a gap. Just ignore that. That's called a centromere. And all chromosomes have that constriction somewhere along their line, but for your purposes, you don't need to know. You can see, if you look very closely, each chromosome has a sort of a dark line along the middle, longitudinally, showing that they are divided already. Now, why is it that we wanted to look at these chromosomes? And why did we stain them all a different colour? Well, by staining them all a different colour, which I just don't have time to go into, we can look to see if chromosomes have swapped material. You get breakages and reunions. They're called translocations. And when translocations occur, that can be harmful. And to illustrate this for you, I better go back just a section. Yeah. If you have every gene, all the genes are arranged longitudinally along the length of a chromosome. There are hundreds, thousands of genes arranged in a very strict order longitudinally along each chromosome. Each gene is like a railway train. It's got an engine at the front, and it's got all the wagons. And the engine is what we call a promoter, and that tells the gene, all the wagons, to be active or remain silent. So when we look at a chromosome, on the left here, we've got a proto-oncogene. Now, this is becoming involved, so I'll cut it down to something simpler. When you cut yourself, the wounds, the cells which survive start dividing. And they divide because there are some enzymes called kinases which come into action. The promoter of the genes making those kinases kick into action and tell the cells to start dividing. Kinases are involved in cell reproduction. When you've got kinases, the cell starts to divide. But normally, the promoter keeps those genes silent. These genes, which promote cell division by kinases, were first discovered in cancer cells. And the scientists at that time gave them a name of proto-oncogene, wrongly named. It's a long name, proto, initial, the first, onco, cancer gene, the first cancer genes. I wish they hadn't called them that, because we do need these genes, these proto-oncogenes, because they function normally in the replenishment of our blood and our skin and the wound when you cut yourself. These proto-oncogenes have their promoters kick into action and tell the gene to produce kinases to fill in the wound, and then they switch off. If you can work out how that's all done, you'd win a Nobel Prize. But anyway, that's how it's done. Now, the reason for telling you all this is that on other chromosomes, there are very active genes. And say the immunoglobulin gene on a different chromosome, which makes antibodies all the time. So they have their own promoter, which is very active. Let's say you have a break. on each of these two chromosomes, one break is just below the proto-oncogene, and on the green chromosome, a break just below the immunoglobulin gene. And let's say the top yellow bit comes down to where the bottom green is, and the bottom green goes up to where the top yellow bit is. Now, the proto-oncogene that was on the yellow chromosome, which was keeping the kinases under control and keeping them silent, now comes under the influence of the active immunoglobulin gene, which is a very active promoter. So the proto-oncogene now becomes an active oncogene, and it starts making kinases, and it tells the cell, start dividing, and you can't stop it. And that's how 80% of all cancers come about, through what are called reciprocal translocations. And radiation damage in particular causes these translocations. So if we look at this chromosome here, you'll see in the middle a yellow and a blue chromosome. That's a translocation. And the blue and the yellow have combined, and that's when you can get an aberrant cell starting up and dividing. I've got other things here, but I think I'm running short of time. These are just other cells which illustrate other combinations of translocations. Here's another one, there's another one. And in the veterans, we start to get complicated ones. Can you see at the top there, it's a combination of different colors. And just below that, there's another one. And down at 7 o'clock, there's a complicated translocation. So we count the translocations. That's what we counted them. And we wanted to see how many translocations there were in 1,000 cells. That's the procedure. Look at that cell, that's a veteran and had really, so the radiation was probably still in their system. Very, very small amounts of radioactive material. So the overall result of this assay, from a total of nearly 10,000 cells scored in the veterans, I'll go down to the bottom. What we found was a highly significant increase in the number of translocations per 1,000 cells in the veterans. There was a mean of 29.38 translocations in 1,000 cells. That's equivalent to what the Chernobyl cleanup workers were exposed to. And compare that with the controls, there was a mean of only 10, which is what you'd find in 70-year-old men who are healthy. When these results first came out, I got phone calls from Britain. There was a benefactor who wanted to remain anonymous. I didn't know who he was. But he was willing to fund further research. And so he got these clever lawyers who had a good science background to ring me, and it was supposed to be a half an hour talk on the phone with several people. And 2 hours later, we're still talking. And there was one lawyer who was doing his job of due diligence. And he said, "Now, can you be absolutely certain that this was due to the atomic bomb going off?" And I said, "Well, in biology, you cannot be 100% concerned. In mathematics, you can, but not in biology. You can only say that the results support this view, and that it's a very convincing results." And he said, "Well, is there any test you can do that would show one way or the other whether?" I said, "Yes, there is." And he said, "What is it? We'll do it. We'll fund it." I said, "You repeat the experiment. You let off an atomic bomb 20 miles off the coast of England and see whether or not it has any threat." And you could hear the other end, you know, bloody Antipodeans, you know, clever bastards, you know. So anyway, the lawyer, I mean the judge who heard the case for the veterans, actually mentioned that in his summary, that conversation that I said, and he said he called upon the British government to take that up and see if they would be willing to let atomic bombs off the coast of Britain and they would maybe volunteer to be observers. But anyway, jokes aside, and it's not a joke, we go to my conclusion was the New Zealand naval personnel who participated in Operation Grapple have incurred long-term genetic damage as shown by this particular assay. So I'll finish there, and if there are any questions, please ask me. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Has anybody done a genetic study of the offspring of the thing, and in particular offspring born before the tests versus offspring born after the tests?
That's a very good question. And that is what we will be trying to do. Tracy and I are still lobbying the politicians to come up with funding to look at the children, because that is a very important question to answer, and the grandchildren. The John Key government gave me an OBE for the study, what do they call it nowadays? And so I've got the kudos, but the veterans have never been acknowledged. And Roy and I have knocked on many doors in the Beehive and spoken to many successive ministers of Veterans Affairs, and face to face, this is terrible, yes, we support that. But it's a yes minister thing. Behind the scenes, the Defence Department, Ministry of Veterans Affairs, I don't know who it is, whisper, it's the consequences of accepting that something bad happened. But I believe if you live in a civilised society, you've just got to face up to it and say, something bad happened here and we acknowledge that. That's what I believe. But anyway, yes.
Other questions? Graham.
I just want to make another comment that the DDT use in New Zealand is another issue where the government agencies don't want to acknowledge things because of the consequences down the line.
I quite believe that. Yes.
Great.
Well, I was just going to say that Vassar University was also a place I was involved in, and we had a research ethics committee. So all of the research that we've been had for 40 years at RFIL has been subject to critical ethics assessment to ensure that it's been done properly and done well. And I think it really disturbs me immensely since then, and we got to know a bit more about how that people keep on questioning, but don't really want to come to grips with the findings of the study, which was a perfectly controlled study, perfect for solutions, perfect for answering the question. Okay, there'll be degrees of MP after the Nth one is there, and you know that, but yeah. I really wanted to say that it's a really important piece of research, and it's a great pity that there's not further work being done in relation to it.
Thank you so much for those kind words, Graham. Much appreciated. Yes.
Was there any difference on the personnel on the two boats? You know, the previous speaker talked about one sailed through ground zero and the boat he was on was 60 miles away.
Yes, that's a good question too. No, the answer is we didn't get any data on that because we were running short of actually participants, and it would have been statistically unsupportive to, even if we'd started to find something. We just didn't have enough participants, but thanks for asking the question.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to me.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks very much, Al, and Terry, and Tracy, sister. It just goes to show, you know, what did go on during that period. And as I said, it is a work in progress. Because if the government will realise their responsibility, depending on how many veterans, but it's not only the veterans, that their ongoing family connections, and that we do know that a number of the family individuals where, you know, their sons and grandsons, some of the sons or daughters are not getting married because they know that they have genetic damage, and so that they don't want their offspring to be deformed in any way or affected in any way. And that there have been examples, haven't there, of numerous...
My daughter.
Yeah. Well, Terry, yeah. There are numerous examples of this, so, you know, that is a concern. I don't want to embarrass Mike, but Mike Peterson, who's our resident expert on the CBRN, Chemical, Biological, Nuclear and Radiological Defence for the New Zealand Army, and it's something that's dear to us engineer hearts because it's a particular subject topic that we are responsible for. But I just wondered, Mike, have you got any sort of views or comments on, you know, some of the early training? Because those pellets that I recall that came from the Christchurch Radiological Laboratory that we used to use for training hurriedly got returned to Australia, didn't they, some years ago?
Yeah, if you can appreciate, when we became nuclear free, whatever that year was,
84.
It was a big umbrella. Yeah. I was in Australia at the time at the Nuclear Biological and Chemical Warfare Instructors Wing as an instructor. And the isotopes that we used, although weak, you would not put them in your pocket, as mentioned. And when you found them, because that was the purpose, to try and find where the isotopes were, you then stopped the exercise there, they were removed, and then you carried on with your training. And it was a surprise to hear that when they actually died down and lost their power, they were sent to Victoria University in Wellington to be recharged and then sent back to Australia. The results from your tests, although you won't find this written down, and I'll probably get shot straight after this, changed our training somewhat, to the point where in New Zealand, in the Defence Force, I don't know about outside that, if there is anything outside the Defence Force, do not do any training with radiation whatsoever, anymore. It's a risk that we will not take. Whether it's right, correct, indifferent, wrong, whatever you did, it gave a bit of a knee-jerk reaction somewhere because we stopped overnight training in radioactive warfare.
And in fact, the only other area is with the Health Department, the Ministry of Health, and their nuclear medicine. And that's pretty much where it resided, apart from the laboratories in Christchurch, which took control of this for the whole of New Zealand. But that was about the end of it, wasn't it, Mike?
Right, yeah. To be honest, you can't get away. We've got reactors all over New Zealand for good reason.
Yeah.
X-ray machines, all that sort of thing. And there are some missing at the moment from USSR, in the days of the USSR. When they went USSR defunct and went to Russia, they parked up a lot of submarines with reactors on board, and those submarines now, some of them are empty because they've been stolen. That is, you can Google that, that's no secret. Where are those? Where are they?
I saw one when I was on that delegation in Moscow, the Institute of High Temperatures, and when was that, 1989 or 1990? And in fact, in the foyer, the entrance foyer, was the nuclear reactor propulsion unit that was used in that fictitious thing, Hunt for the Red October, if you recall that particular novel. But a lot of that was pretty true to form. And I've actually got a photo of it, we've actually got it out in the museum, of that particular propulsion unit sitting in this display cabinet, which was a nuclear fissile reactor. So this sort of stuff is going on all the time. Yeah, an interesting topic, very scary, but I guess, touch wood, given that we're still non-radioactive, or the Geiger counter doesn't go off every time you go and see the doctor, we keep our fingers crossed that we're still in reasonable nick. But what we don't know is what's going on, you know, in generations following. And that's the scary thing, isn't it, Al?
It is. And don't forget, there's a lot of radiation comes from the sun. You stand it there too long, you're going to get radiation burns.
Absolutely. All right, well, look, I'd just like to take this opportunity once again, and please join me in thanking Al, Terry, Tracy for the presentation today. it only whet the appetite, but as you can see, there's still more to be done on this particular topic. So thanks very much.